Minnesota Court of Appeals via Zoom. Today is Thursday, February 3rd, 2022. We have five cases on our calendar for today. Two are set for oral argument. This is the second of the two set for oral argument. This case number 821-0986 in the matter of the denial of contested case hearing request and a reissuance of National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System / State Disposal System permit number MN0020238 for the City of Osakis Wastewater Treatment Facility. That is a mouthful. Thank you both for appearing via Zoom. We will be recording this. No other recordings are permitted. We thank you for joining us virtually. We realize that this may we may at times run into some technical issues. If we do, we'll make sure we accommodate both parties. We've experienced that both from attorneys as well as from the bench. So we are cognizant of that fact. When you're speaking, please make sure that you are unmuted. When you're not speaking, please make sure that you are muted so there's no background noise at all. Each counsel will have 15 minutes for their initial statements. Counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. With that, counsel for appellant, and also there will be a clock that you can see the time, so please be cognizant of that as well. With that, counsel, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing, and you may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Daniel Marks, and I'm representing the realtor in this case, the City of Osakis. Now, this court typically grants significant deference to an agency when it's carrying out their regulatory functions and operating in the area of its technical expertise. However, the record in this case is very unique, and based upon the facts in this case, MPCA is not entitled to such deference with respect to its decision in this case for three key reasons. First, every regulatory and technical finding made by the agency in this case has been tainted by its attempt to violate the plain language of its own lake eutrophication water quality standards. Now, MPCA in its brief attempts to dodge this error by hiding behind 40 CFR 122.44D1, Roman numeral small i3, but that dodge fails principally for two reasons. First, MPCA's interpretation is unreasonable because it directly contradicts both the agency's position as articulated in its brief and this court's holding in Winstead. Secondly, the dodge fails because the regulation cited by MPCA only really states that a permit limit is needed in this case, when really the issue in this case is whether the specific limit is necessary, reasonable, and supported by substantial evidence. The second reason the court need not defer to the agency in this case is fundamentally the agency lacks substantial evidentiary support to support its conclusions. The city has presented a bevy of material evidence, including 4 years of empirical water quality data, which is summarized on page 14 of our reply brief, that conclusively demonstrate that the limit at issue in this case is more restrictive than necessary to attain and maintain water quality standards. And it is simply unreasonable for the agency to conclude otherwise based on its outdated 2014 modeling analysis, where its own experts and the agency's external experts have acknowledged that that modeling is deficient for this case. And then third, the record in this case is replete with procedural irregularities, technical and legal mistakes by the MPCA, the fundamental of which is its failure to give the city the lawfully required notice as a part of the permitting process that the agency intended to rely and did rely upon the Lake Pepin TMDL study as a basis for the effluent limit in this case. And I really want to highlight this point to make it clear to the court what the agency did here. The agency took the same limit that the city has been actively contesting in the permitting process and in an open, presently stayed, contested case hearing process in the Lake-Osakis area TMDL matter took that same limit and put it in an appendix to the Lake Pepin TMDL study and failed to give the city the lawfully required notice that it was doing that and relying upon the Lake Pepin study as a part of the permitting process. And that's a substantive, it affected the city's substantive rights because it is this permitting process via which the city can comment and seek to amend the waste load allocation in the Lake Pepin TMDL study. So principally, it's for these three key reasons that the agency does not deserve the deference that this court would typically afford it in this case. And the city has conclusively demonstrated that it has met its burden and deserves and warrants a contested case hearing in this matter. Excuse me, just for a moment.
Counsel, as on your argument regarding the third point about the notice on the Lake Pepin TMDL, in your reply brief, I think you argue that that number isn't set in stone and can be adjusted in terms of the waste load that's allocated to the city's wastewater treatment plant. So given your argument, how is the city prejudiced by the lack of notice? Help me understand your prejudice argument.
The prejudice in this case is that because the MPCA failed to provide the city notice as a part of the statement of basis of the permit or the technical memorandum that the agency used to justify the effluent limit, which all of those of which are required under state and federal law, the city did not have the opportunity to make its case to the agency as a part of the permitting process that the waste load allocation that it was putting into the Lake Pepin TMDL was more restrictive than necessary. And that the city didn't have the opportunity to raise it as an issue as a part of the contested case process and to seek to adjust that TMDL waste load allocation during the permitting process as normally would be allowed.
So, go ahead.
Well, maybe it's related. Did the agency give public notice of its the allocation in the Pepin TMDL, and is that legally sufficient?
The notice that the agency gave about the Lake Pepin TMDL itself was legally sufficient, but the agency was also required to give the city specific notice as a part of the permitting process that the agency was relying upon that pollution study as a basis for the limit. And if you look at the record, the agency in its technical memorandum justifying this limit refers to the Lake Osakis area TMDL study, which was the TMDL study that the city contested and had in the contested cases ongoing or presently stayed in the administrative law judge by the administrative law judge.
What's your legal authority for that requirement of specific notice?
That issue is covered in our principal brief at page 18, note 15, and page 36 generally. So the citations for there are generally, but the general legal requirement under state and federal law is for the agency to provide the city a technical memorandum, a fact sheet, or a statement of basis that includes the basic legal justifications and the basic factual basis for an effluent limit.
Okay, thanks for that citation. I'll yield back to Judge Cochran because I may have interrupted her. Thanks.
Thank you, Judge Johnson. You asked the very question that I was going to ask. maybe I can ask a question related to your first point, Mr. Marks. So, I think I understand your argument about the rule and how your position that the agency erroneously applied the rule. As applied to Fail Lake, am I pronouncing the name of that lake correctly?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So Fail Lake is now no longer impaired, but as I understand the record, Lake Osakis is still impaired. So how did the erroneous legal interpretation as to the rule, in your view, taint the determination of the you know, the need for an affluent limit to protect Osakis Lake or to help Osakis Lake become unimpaired?
Thank you, Your Honor. So there's two points to make in response to that question. First, when MPCA developed the limit for the city, it is applying the lake eutrophication standards for Fail Lake, not Lake Osakis. And then secondly, the agency's position argument that the limit is also necessary to protect Lake Osakis and downstream waters all the way to Lake Pepin is not supported by substantial evidence. If you look at our reply brief at pages 18 through 21, we talk about this and really demonstrate that MPCA didn't perform a separate and discrete analysis demonstrating that this limit was necessary to attain and maintain standards in Lake Osakis or Lake Pepin. In Lake Osakis, for example, when they did the pollution study for Lake Osakis and the modeling analysis to determine what phosphorus reduction needed to be made in Lake Osakis, the agency simply assumed that the city would be meeting this limit and that Fail Lake would be meeting the water quality standard, or at least the phosphorus component thereof. So the agency's position about the need for this limit to protect downstream waters is simply not supported by substantial evidence. Their record is all tied to Fail Lake, and then the discussion about the necessity of the limit for downstream waters is basically an assumption that if Fail Lake meets these numbers, then they bake that into the analysis for Osakis and downstream waters. I hope that addresses your question.
Mr. Mark, so if I accept your argument that it's necessary for the agency to consider not just the measurements about the total phosphorus, but also the effects or the responses, with respect to Lake Osakis, it seems like there is some evidence in the record of the current conditions or the current effects. I'm looking at your addendum, page 57 of your addendum, and that's a page from. I'm looking specifically at the attachment to the agency's response to your comments, and there was an attachment called justification for the 121 number. And this has, so there are on that page, you may remember it has that, you know, samples were taken in years 15, 16, 17, and 18. And it showed that the disc measurement was 1.9 instead of 1.4 and that the chlorophyll A measurement was 24 instead of 14. So the Lake Osakis is still in impaired status at that time. Doesn't that allow the agency to make a determination that that a Q-bill is necessary in order to ensure that there is not an exceedance of both the causal measurement and the responsive measurement?
Your Honor, I think the question is, or what you're pointing out is that Lake Osakis is still impaired. And I think what this goes to is that the city isn't disputing that it needs a phosphorus limit, right? But essentially, what the city's point is that the city, MPCA, gave it a phosphorus limit based upon Fail Lake, based upon the outdated information about Fail Lake, and it hasn't done a separate and discrete analysis about what limit would be necessary for Lake Osakis, which is now the applicable downstream impaired water. And basically, our position is that the law in this case, now that Fail Lake has been delisted and the empirical water quality data conclusively demonstrate that the city can discharge above the limit and Fail Lake can exceed its TP criterion, that essentially MPCA now needs to develop a limit that is set at the level necessary to protect Lake Osakis. And they haven't done that. They gave us a limit for Fail. And the city's position is that if they were to do that, it would be a much less restrictive limit because the city's impact on Lake Osakis is even less than it is on Fail Lake. So I hope that answers your question.
Can I follow up, Judge Johnson and Judge Reyes?
Yes.
Thank you. So looking at that same document, and recognizing that the city needs a phosphorus limit to address the impaired condition of Lake Osakis. What is the problem with the legally with the approach that the MPCA took, which is figuring out what load is workable for Lake Osakis to meet its the LES criteria, and then going backwards and assigning a load to a limit for Fail Lake, and then backwards from that to the wastewater treatment facility.
So if I understand your question, Your Honor, I think the legal error, right? And I think we discussed this in our reply brief where we cite MPCA's guidance about how it intends to apply Federal Regulation 40 CFR 122.41D and the Lake Eutrophication Standards. Is essentially MPCA has not set, as required by federal law and acknowledged by MPCA, has not set the level, set the limit at a level that is necessary to attain and maintain water quality standards in Fail Lake or Lake Osakis. And what the agency should have done, and the record shows that they did some of this analysis, is they should have looked at the city's current discharge levels when they were doing this analysis, and then determined if the current discharge levels were sufficiently protective of Fail Lake. And if they weren't sufficiently protective of Fail Lake, determined if they were sufficiently protective of Fail Lake, which the record, oops, I'm out of time, so I'll stop.
Council, you may finish your question, or okay. Answering the question.
So essentially, the MPCA did an analysis which is talked about in our reply brief, looking at what the impact of the interim limit, the city were only to meet its interim limit, the 283 kilogram per year limit, would be on Fail Lake and Lake Osakis. And essentially, that record and that analysis showed that that limit in of itself would be sufficiently protective of Fail Lake and downstream waters. And so bottom line is agency doesn't have substantial evidence that this limit is set at the level necessary to attain and maintain standards in Lake Osakis or downstream waters.
Judge Reyes, can I just ask a very quick follow-up?
Sure.
So, Council, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that the level that they set is sufficient but not necessary. They haven't demonstrated it's necessary.
Correct, Your Honor.
Or the record. Really, there isn't substantial evidence to demonstrate it's necessary.
And really what the record shows is that the agency calculated this limit really one time when they misapplied the lake standards to the Clifford wetland. And then since then, they've just been seeking new justifications to keep that limit in place.
Judge Reyes, could I ask another follow-up question?
Or yes, absolutely.
Actually a new question, not a follow-up question. Mr. Marks, drawing your attention to your expert's report and your request for a contested case hearing, could you characterize, does your expert provide data and analysis that is, does it directly contradict or clash with the agency's data and analysis, or does it go beyond? Does it address other issues that the agency did not consider? In other words, it provides additional data and analysis. Can you, please comment on the extent to which it does one or the other?
Yes, thank you, Judge. And to clarify, the agency put in evidence from two separate experts. I believe what you're referring to is the detailed modeling that the city provided information from two experts. I'm going to talk about the detailed modeling that the city provided from its expert, Mr. Joe Bischoff. And so in response to your question, the city's expert modeling analysis not only directly contradicted the agency's findings in this case and the agency's modeling analysis, but as you stated, it went further And essentially, the city's expert, and just think about this, the city hired the same national expert that MPCA used to develop the original bathtub model that the agency used in 2013 for the Osakis Lake Area TMDL, Mr. Joe Bischoff. And Mr. Bischoff, in his report, stated, along with internal experts from the agency, that MPCA's bathtub model was not capable of accurately assessing the city's discharge and how it impacts Fail Lake and downstream waters, because the city has a different type of wastewater treatment plant, the seasonal discharge, which is distinct from a continual discharge. And so Mr. Bischoff built a specific daily time step model that was geared towards specifically evaluating the seasonal nature of the city's discharge and how it impacted Fail Lake and downstream waters. So the brief response is, not only did our evidence directly contradict the agency's findings, but our model was able to do things that the agency's own experts acknowledged that its model couldn't do.
And if I may, so the agency's argument in response to that was that the seasonal aspect of the releases did not have a significant influence on the analysis because it takes 1 or 2 months for the phosphorus to travel, and the fact that it, you know, given the residence time of water in the lake, you know, that it's longer than a season anyway. And I'm not sure if you responded to that in your reply brief or not, but could you please provide an oral rebuttal of that part of the agency's argument?
Yeah, so basically in the agency's brief, they artfully reply by essentially stating that, well, they did consider the seasonal discharge characteristics of the city. And in our brief, we point out, well, that's maybe true, but they considered it as if it was a continuous discharge. They didn't accurately consider it, which is really the point, and which is what their expert acknowledged. And the agency also said that, well, we don't need to look at these shorter term conditions, and that's why we can use the annual average, you know, lump sum model. But that's not true for Fail Lake. Fail Lake is an extremely shallow lake, and the record demonstrates that it's got a residence time of something like 14 days, which is extremely short. And so the agency's response on that point simply misses the mark. And so I think I'll leave that, but it's well covered in our reply brief.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions from my colleagues? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, I realize that we did go, I think, approximately about 6 minutes over. And if you do need a little bit extra time, we will certainly grant it. We know that this is a fairly complicated case, and there's a lot of document, a lot of materials. So we will extend you the same courtesy as well. So with that, please say your name for the record, your party, the party you are representing, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Stacy Person, and I represent the Pollution Control Agency. The MPCA included a 121 kilogram per year phosphorus limit in the city of Osakis's permit because the agency found that the discharge from the city's wastewater treatment facility does have the reasonable potential to cause or contribute to a violation of water quality standards for downstream waters. The permit limit is based on a whole host of considerations, such as the water quality of all the connected downstream waters, the unique characteristics of those water bodies, like the fact that Fail Lake is shallow and can quickly move from a clear, unimpaired state to a turbid or murky, algae-dominated state. MPCA considered all the four sources of phosphorus, not just the city's discharge, but also non-point sources of phosphorus, like agricultural runoff. And MPCA balanced the relative reductions needed from each of those sources.
Ms. Pearson,
MPCA,
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but we all read the briefs and all the material, so we're very cognizant of the information. I want to go to a little bit of specific information. You argue that Minnesota Rule 7050.0222, you emphasize that is what is applicable in this case. And in that rule, it talks about the exceedance levels, and it talks about how you look at the total phosphorus and either the chlorophyll A or the Secchi disc transparency, that those either you have to find total phosphorus is out of limits, and either the chlorophyll A or the Secchi disc transparency are out of limits in order to find that the lake is in a polluted condition, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead and finish your question, Your Honor.
Sure. And so if that's the case, and that's analysis that the PCA undertook for Lake Vail initially, correct?
Yes, the lake eutrophication standard is at 7050.02222. And
okay.
And MPCA used that standard when it was deciding whether Fail Lake was impaired or not impaired. And the impairment analysis comes from 7050.0150. So that's where the rules tell us that we look at whether there's a violation of both phosphorus, the causal variable, and at least one of the response variables. Okay. If that's the case, then the lake is impaired and gets listed as an impaired water for the state.
Okay. And so Lake Vail was on that list because it did not meet that equation, shall we say.
Correct. It was on that list until 2020.
Correct. And then in 2020, it was taken off the list because even though the phosphorus levels were still high, the chlorophyll A and the Secchi disc transparency tests were below the limits.
That's right. Okay, At the time, there was monitoring data that showed that those response variables had come into attainment.
Okay, so that's now delisted. And so I have several questions. That's the test that's used. That's the model that's used to determine that, according to what you said. And so was that test done on Lake Osakis itself?
Lake Osakis, no one here is contesting that Lake Osakis is impaired. So we all agree Lake Osakis does not meet the test.
Okay. So we don't need to worry about that. Now, all we're talking about is Lake Vail. That's what you're relying on, correct?
Well, no, Your Honor. We are looking at the whether Vail Lake is impaired just for purposes of is that lake going to be on the state's list of impaired waters or not. To set the permit limit, which is the thing that's on appeal here, the permit limit is a different test. The permit limit comes from an analysis that is in federal regulations, 40 CFR 122.44D1. Totally different test. That's the reasonable potential analysis. And the question is, does the discharge have the reasonable potential to violate the water quality standard? So here, the water quality standard at issue is the lake eutrophication standard. That's the Minnesota rule 7050.0222. That's the standard that we're looking at. The question is, does the discharge, the city's discharge, have the reasonable potential to violate that standard? Now, the thing that's in the city's discharge is phosphorus. Right? Nobody's discharging chlorophyll A. Nobody's discharging Secchi discs. They're discharging phosphorus. So what the agency does is it looks at the phosphorus in that discharge and tries to determine, is it likely that the phosphorus in the discharge is going to cause a violation of the lake eutrophication standard in Fail Lake or in any downstream water. And here they said, yes, even though Fail Lake is currently not impaired, we're really concerned about maintaining the water quality in Fail Lake, because MPCA, in the process of finding that Fail Lake was not impaired, said, we believe it's not impaired because the discharge from the city's facility has actually been meeting the 121 kilogram per year limit for a whole bunch of years leading up to the time where the lake came into attainment with the standards. So MPCA looked at that data and said, Fail Lake is only in attainment in large part because the city's discharge met the 121 kilogram limit that was in their previous permit and is still in their permit today. And so,
Council, in making that determination as to whether Fail Lake was, whether the phosphorus discharges from the wastewater treatment facility were, had the reasonable potential to cause Fail Lake to become impaired, basically, right? Or to violate the lake eutrophication standards in 7050.022, did the MPCA consider both variables? Because it's not in a polluted state without, if the total phosphorus is above the limit, there also has to be one of the response variables has to not be met.
Yes. So MPCA in the reasonable potential analysis is considering all the variables, but the test is phosphorus is really the causal variable, and phosphorus is the pollutant at issue in the actual discharge. So the expectation, and this is the way the eutrophication standards are set up. It was part of the entire rulemaking proceeding when that rule was enacted, is that there is a relationship between phosphorus and the other variables. And the expected relationship is that if you have too much phosphorus, you're going to see the algae growth response and the lack of clarity in the water that's measured by Secchi depth.
And, so, and you may, but don't we have, I mean, when we look at, and you cite to Lake Osakis about the fact that the water through the, runs through there, it's a larger lake, and the water runs through there in a, and it's a deeper lake, much deeper lake, in a much lower capacity. But in Fail Lake, it's a much, much more shallow lake. The water runs through there much faster. And so when you talk about the relationship, yes, there is a relationship between the phosphorus and the chlorophyll A and the transparency. But if the levels of the, if the transparency are, is below the limits and the chlorophyll A is below the limits, even when it is known that the phosphorus is still higher, it sounds like you're saying, well, just because phosphorus is higher, per se, you're going to have an issue with chlorophyll A or transparency. But don't you have to have data to support that assumption?
So, Your Honor, your question...
And what is that data? What is that data?
Yes. So, Your Honor, your question is getting at really the what Relator brings up as they wanted a site-specific standard for Fail Lake, because their position is the eco-region-wide standard for shallow lakes, which for Fail is 60 micrograms per liter of phosphorus, and then corresponding numbers of chlorophyll A and Secchi depth. The 60 is the thing I'm going to focus on here. They say we don't need to get down to 60 in Fail Lake for phosphorus because the response variables don't respond in Fail Lake specifically. And MPCA looked at that. They said they evaluated the question of should we have a site-specific standard for Fail Lake? And they said, no. There's a couple reasons that it doesn't make sense to do that. One reason is we can decide whether we can make this the determination under 70.
Aren't those two separate questions? One is whether there's a reasonable potential to violate the standard, the lake eutrophication standards, and another is whether there should be a site-specific standard. And the lake eutrophication standard includes both a causal and a response variables. So, given the record in this case where Fail Lake was delisted because that relationship wasn't there between the causal and response variables, in order to say that now, in looking at whether there's the reasonable potential here, isn't it necessary for the agency to support that decision with specific information, not just an assumption?
So, Your Honor, I'll jump ahead because that goes to what I was going to say is the second reason they didn't establish a site-specific standard. It wouldn't make a difference for the reasonable potential analysis because, for one thing, historically, the reason that Fail Lake came into attainment is because the phosphorus discharge from the city's facility lowered and was meeting the 121 kilogram per year limit. And there's data in the record that supports that. There are tables that support that. I believe one of them is at, well, I'll get that for you in a second. Also because we're not just protecting Fail Lake. And this is a really important point. We are also protecting Lake Osakis and all the downstream waters. And Fail Lake needs to meet the 60 micrograms per liter phosphorus that is in the ecoregion-wide water quality standard. Because if Fail Lake doesn't hit 60, Lake Osakis cannot hit 40. And
okay,
that
council,
is the standard
but
for
I
Lake
thought you
Osakis.
Said that we're, a council, I thought you said we're just focusing on Lake Fail. And now you're talking about what we need to do to protect Lake Osakis. But if that's the case, don't we need to look at the levels, the eutrophication levels at Lake Osakis then, which was my earlier comment. That's my first comment. But going back to this, the question that Judge Cochran asked, what is the, I have the same question and concern. What is the specific data now after 2020, now that Fail Lake has been delisted, that it is not meeting the eutrophication's dual causal response standard?
So, Your Honor, I apologize if I misspoke earlier and didn't understand your question. I do want to be clear that the agency was never solely focused on Fail Lake. The agency at all times was looking at Fail and every downstream water all the way to Lake Pepin. So I want to be really clear on that point. And there is a lot of record evidence to that point. The June 2020 memo that's in the record, it's in the city's addendum, pages around pages 56 and ongoing, the 2011 memo that the agency used to initially set the limit, that is in the record at starting around page 233. So there's a lot of record evidence and modeling of the impacts on Lake Osakis. Then, as to your question about how do we know Fail Lake is getting worse, we have modeling data from the city itself.
Are you relying on the bathtub modeling?
No, sorry, we have monitoring data from the city itself. This is and it's from 2019 and 2020. And the agency looked at that, and this is at record page 1846. It's also cited in our brief, and said, look at this. In the last couple of years, the phosphorus discharge from the city has gone up, and chlorophyll A is getting worse, and transparency is getting worse. This confirms the agency's conclusions that Fail Lake is only currently in attainment because the city's discharges had decreased leading up to it coming into attainment. The Clean Water Act and all the rules, Minnesota rules, federal rules, require not just current or protection of waters that are not in attainment, it also requires that the agency maintain water quality standards. Fail Lake, because it's a shallow lake, again, this is also in the record, the characteristics specific to Fail Lake, because it's a shallow lake, it is has a tendency to go quickly from a clear state to an algae-dominated state.
Okay, Ms. Pearson, I understand the requirement that the PCA follow to make sure that they maintain it. My concern, my question is, what is the specific data, and not just historical data, but current data on the status of the lake to justify the number, the historic number that is being used? Because the number hasn't changed, even though Lake Vail has been delisted. You know, what is the data? And that's the first question. The second question is, why isn't that the modeling that was done by the expert that the city used, who was actually the expert that the PCA used to develop the bathtub model, why isn't that new evidence that would require a contested hearing to be held to make sure that there's careful consideration of that data? But the first question is really the key question.
So the data, and Your Honor, if you'll indulge me just for a moment, I want to clarify that the Clean Water Act nowhere says the limit has to be the least restrictive limit that can be imposed. And it couldn't say that, because what's going on here is a balancing. We don't have phosphorus coming just from the city's wastewater treatment plant. We also have phosphorus coming from a lot of other sources. And part of the city's position has always been, look, the amount of phosphorus that we contribute is so small, you really should be hammering down a lot more on the other sources, especially agricultural runoff. And so when you ask me about data, part of the data of why we are at this 121 kilogram per year limit is the fact that they're making relative reductions and looking at what's feasible for other sources also to reduce. And what the agency did with agricultural sources was it said, we're going to make them reduce by 74%. They're making the city reduce by 15%. They're making agricultural sources reduce by 74%. That is a lot of phosphorus from agricultural sources. That is based on very aggressive assumptions about what is possible. In fact, there's not any other scenario in which MPCA has assumed that agriculture will reduce by 74%. But they have made that assumption here. And that is what balances out the fact that the city can discharge at 121 kilograms per year. If the city were to discharge at higher than that, the city wants to say they should be able to discharge at 283 kilograms per year. If they were to discharge at that level, agriculture would have to come down way more.
And that's based on an assumption or with the goal of Fail Lake meeting a standard of 60 micrograms per liter. Is that correct?
And not
considering the response criteria.
That is also based on looking at Lake Osakis and what it has to meet as well. And the agriculture and the what's coming from Fail Lake in terms of phosphorus and entering Lake Osakis from not only Fail Lake, but also other sources in the Lake Osakis watershed.
Just to be clear, that's based on the total phosphorus number alone, correct?
No, Your Honor. They're applying the lake eutrophication standard, right? And again,
like so you're we're saying, talking. I'm sorry, just you are saying that the response criteria were taken into account in developing the 121 kilograms per year standard, or is that right?
they're taken into account in the sense that the entire standard is derived from the lake eutrophication standard that has a phosphorus component and the response variable components. The thing in the discharge is phosphorus. Phosphorus is also known as the causal component. So phosphorus is the thing that is acted on. Phosphorus is the only thing the agency can control. It's the only thing they can really regulate.
In setting the limit and determining what's necessary in order for the lake to meet the standard that is being considered is only the total phosphorus standard. That's what I was focusing on in my question. Not what the limit is on, but what standard is seeking to be met.
The limit is for phosphorus.
Correct.
And the reasonable potential analysis primarily uses that phosphorus number as an input. And again, if we look at the federal regulations here, 122.44D1, what MPCA did is 100% consistent with what these regulations say. They say in Roman numeral little I, the limitations must control all pollutants. Here, the pollutant is phosphorus. And then if we go on and we continue.
Let's stop there. So D1, Romanet I, says including state narrative criteria for water quality. So are you suggesting that the state has an independent standalone standard for phosphorus that's not connected to the response criteria for purposes of federal law?
Not at all, Your Honor. It's lake eutrophication standard.
Correct. Okay. Since we agree on that, then how does the federal law authorize the MPCA to set the limit based solely on the total phosphorus without regard to the response criteria?
And Your Honor, MPCA didn't do that here. They didn't do that.
In your brief, do you clarify that MPCA didn't do that here? Maybe I misunderstood your brief, but it seemed to me that there wasn't any argument in your brief that the MPCA considered the response criteria.
So taking a step back, Fail Lake is the only lake in this system that is currently in attainment, right? So let's just take Fail Lake out of the picture, hypothetically. Lake Osakis. If this permit were focused on the first water that is not in attainment of current water quality standards, it would be Lake Osakis. The permit limit would be exactly the same if we were only focused on Lake Osakis. No one is arguing that the response variables do not respond as expected with the phosphorus variable in Lake Osakis. No one is arguing that. There is a lot of analysis and data and modeling in the record that says this permit limit needs to be at 121 kilograms per year in order for Lake Osakis to come into attainment. It's an impaired water. The standard needs to be set to protect that downstream water. And the standard is at 121, taking into account all of the sources of phosphorus that are going to be going into that lake and balancing out the relative reductions that are needed. These are all professional scientific judgments that MPCA is making and should receive deference for the judgments it's making based on its balancing and its application of the reasonable potential analysis in federal regulations. There's a lot of case law in this state giving MPCA deference for how it interprets and applies the reasonable potential analysis.
We understand the deference standard, but we also understand there's a standard that there has to be sufficient evidence in the record to support it. I'm going to actually go back to a question I asked about 20 minutes ago, because when I mentioned Lake Osakis, you demurred on that and said we need to focus on Fail Lake. But isn't really Fail Lake the one that you're looking at to make these assumptions? And isn't the assumption based on the total phosphorus rather than the total phosphorus criteria, the causal criteria, without taking into account the response criteria in terms of measurements and data?
No, Your Honor. And when you ask me the question,
where's that data? Help me understand where that evidence is of that, either with Fail Lake or Lake Osakis or Lake Pepin.
So the data and the explanation of the data, you will find that in the June 2020 memo. You will find that in the agency's 2014 memo. You will find that in the agency's 2011 memo. You will find that in the agency's response to comments. There's a much more narrative description of what the data is and what and how MPCA got to its conclusions in the response to comments. They did a very good job here being thorough and explaining how they got to this determination. So the agency has explained itself extremely well here, and they've had about a decade to do that. They've been going back and forth with the city for a decade on this permit limit, with the city saying, we don't think it needs to be 121, and MPCA coming back to the city and explaining time and again, in person, in response to comments in writing, in letter correspondence, no, the number is 121. It needs to be that number for a lot of different reasons, not just Fail Lake. When you asked me at the very beginning of the argument about Fail Lake and whether we were focused on that, my understanding was that your question was about 7050.150 and impairments. And yes, we're looking at, I mean, that we were focused on Fail Lake and is fail impaired under 0.150. If we are talking about the permit limit and the reasonable potential analysis that was done under federal regulations, no, absolutely not just looking at Fail Lake. Looking at the entire system of connected lakes all the way down to Lake Pepin, many of which are impaired. And then we have the Lake Pepin TMDL and the assumptions of that TMDL and all the waste allocations in that TMDL, of which the city of Osakis is one. That TMDL assumes that every lake along the connected path will be meeting water quality standards. So that TMDL assumes Fail is going to meet 60, so that Lake Osakis then can meet 40. So that Guernsey Lake then can meet the number it has to meet, and on and on down the path.
Yes, Judge Cochran.
Can I ask a couple more questions? I know we're out of time.
This is
a very interesting and complicated case. So,
could I just know before we go too much further, I have a couple of questions too, Judge Reyes, that I've been saving, with not wanting to interrupt the prior lines of questioning.
We're well past the time, but I think this case requires a little bit more discussion. So I appreciate you answering the questions, Ms. Pearson, and we'll have Judge Cochran ask some questions and then Judge Johnson as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you to counsel for entertaining some additional questions. Earlier you said that nowhere in the Clean Water Act does it say that the agency is required to set the limit at the least restrictive limit. So how does the agency then determine what is necessary for the wastewater treatment facility? What limit is necessary for the wastewater treatment facility? How do you define necessary then?
So first of all, that word necessary, I'm not entirely sure where that comes from. That doesn't jump out at me as being part of the regulations itself. That, putting that aside, what the agency is doing is looking at all the sources of pollution, and I'm trying to flip to the response to comments. There's a pretty good There's a pretty good explanation here, if I can find it. Yes. So this is in response to an affidavit that the city submitted with its petition for a contested case hearing. I'm looking at the city addendum, page 43 and 44. And here again, the comment is that fail should be able to have more than the standard of 60 micrograms per liter of phosphorus because its response variables are in compliance. And the answer this to city comment number 5 is, look, there's nothing that has been provided to us that shows us that Fail Lake could not exceed the standard again in the future if the conditions are similar to what they've been in the past. If the city's discharge increases, we believe, MPCA believes, the standard will again be violated. Then it continues on to the next page, and they say, also, if Fail Lake were not expected to meet its 60 microgram per liter phosphorus criterion in the future, greater reductions would have to be obtained in other portions of the Lake Osakis watershed. Mr. Hall's affidavit, the city's expert's affidavit, does not provide any basis for evaluating the implication that the current allocation methodology is inequitable. It's an allocation that MPCA is doing. They are allocating the phosphorus load of all the different sources, and they have to make what they deem to be an equitable allocation and also a feasible allocation. So the June 2020 memo, and this you can find at in the city addendum at pages 57 to 58, this is where they talk about the 74% reduction in non-point sources. And they say that assumes aggressive reductions from direct runoff and upstream wetlands. The direct runoff target in the TMDL is 75 micrograms per liter of phosphorus, which is lower than the phosphorus criterion for the river eutrophication standards for this region. Allocating an even larger portion of Fail Lake's loading capacity to the city's wastewater treatment facility would require an even greater non-point source load reduction, which is infeasible. So it's a balancing. It's a professional judgment being applied and balancing out what is possible, attainable, feasible, and reasonable for all the various loads. And we know that the city can meet the 121 kilogram per year discharge limit because they did that for a whole lot of years. From 2012 on, they did it. So this is not something that is not possible for the city to do.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. Then, you know, setting aside Fail Lake and Osakis is, everyone agrees, impaired. The justification for the 121 kilograms per liter total phosphorus effluent limit, I've reviewed that carefully, and it focuses in great deal on Osakis and meeting the what's necessary for Osakis to meet the standards, but it appears that that's driven by an assumption for Fail Lake, which then drives the number for the wastewater treatment facility. And so can you discuss whether the MPCA did any sort of independent analysis or modeling to determine what's necessary for Osakis to meet the LES lake eutrophication standards, as opposed to simply backdooring, you know, taking a previous assumption and just plugging it in and saying that's what we're going to do?
Well, Your Honor, that comes, we can see that, again, in the response to comments, the city addendum, page 41, MPCA's response number 4 gets into that issue. We also see that back in the 2011 memo. This is, you can find this in the record, MPCA page 233, it begins. And this talks about various scenarios that were modeled. And
for OSACIS one of those, in particular?
Well, for the whole watershed. I mean, this is Fail Lake, Lake OSACIS, and it's also talking about, this is what's I think helpful about this model, this memo, is it explains, for example, that in one of the scenarios, they ran just a reduction in non-point sources, and they found if we only reduce non-point sources, we won't meet the standards. They did just a reduction based on the city's facility alone, and they said if we only make the city's facility have a reduction, we won't meet the standards. We need to instead have everybody reduce, right? And so that gives a nice explanation of that point. There was one other, let's see here. There's also analysis of OSACIS in the, again, in the response to comments.
I'm sorry, maybe I should rephrase my question. After Fail Lake was delisted, was there any additional analysis done by the MPCA to determine how OSACIS, the water, Lake OSACIS could meet its standards for eutrophication that didn't just presume that Fail Lake was at the number that was previously assigned to it?
So, no, and it wasn't necessary. And that's because the number assigned to Fail, the number of 60, again, this goes to the overall sort of allocation question and the issue of do they even need to run scenarios where Fail Lake has more than 60, because they know that if Fail Lake has more than 60, Lake OSACIS is not going to be able to get to 40.
And why is that?
So that's all the modeling, all the citations that I've been telling you.
But that,
and it's also the whole.
Is it true that no other source could reduce in any other way?
Non-point sources in Minnesota are where most of the phosphorus comes from. I mean, let's be honest, right? Mm-hmm. Non-point sources. They cannot reduce any more than what they are already being told to reduce. Also, on top of that, those reductions are voluntary. MPCA doesn't actually have any regulatory controls over non-point sources. It's all going to be best management practices and trying to, you know, work with watershed conservation districts and other entities to try to get best management practices put in place, right? And those things do work, which, and MPCA has seen those things work, which is where their estimates for what's possible in terms of agricultural reductions, where those numbers come from, are things that they've seen in the past, right? But they also know that there's a limit to how much agricultural runoff can be reduced. So in this watershed that we're talking about, the only point source is the city of OSACIS's facility. And the most of the other sources of phosphorus are agricultural and precipitation events. So, you know, there's not a lot here. On top of that, the agency has offered and has been trying to work with the city throughout this entire last decade where we've been talking about permitting issues to help them find ways to meet the 121 kilogram per year limits by trading. So this is the limit gets put into the permit and it's a valid final limit, but there's different ways that they can achieve that. And one of those ways would be crediting and trading.
Ms. Pearson.
Yes.
And I appreciate the answer, but I think we're getting a little bit out of scope. And I want to be cognizant of the time. We're well over time. Just want to see if Judge Cochran had any other additional questions.
I'm sorry. I just have two more, hopefully quick questions. The first is, if you can turn to page 35 of your brief, Ms. Pearson, I just want to clarify, earlier your argument relating to the federal rules and that the federal rules require compliance with the permits. I'm sorry, let me grab the federal rule here. I have it. I have old school paper here. Anyway, that the permit achieved the water quality standards, including state narrative criteria for water quality. And maybe I didn't ask my question very well, but what I was trying to get at is whether the state's position is that what I thought I heard you say is that language requires the state to impose an effluent limit so that the wastewater treatment facility meets the 60 micrograms per liter without consideration of the response criteria. And then I think I later heard you say, no, you consider the criteria as a whole, not just the 60 independently, that the 60 is not a standalone criteria. But your brief seems to suggest that it's the MPCA's position that 60 is a standalone criteria and that the federal rules require a limit to in the permit to meet that criteria. And I just want to clarify what the agency's position is on that. And, to the extent you're relying on the federal rules, I'm not sure. I guess I might have a follow-up question.
So the agency's position is we have to meet the lake eutrophication standard, which has three numeric components, a phosphorus, a chlorophyll A, and a secchi depth. The component of that is the causal and the component that can be controlled is the phosphorus. So the limit is set for phosphorus, right? And it has to meet the 60 number in the rule for phosphorus. And the way the rule is set up, the way the rule was justified to begin with, incorporates the assumption that if you meet the 60 for phosphorus, you also are going to meet the numbers for chlorophyll A and secchi. So it's not a standalone. Phosphorus is not standalone. Phosphorus is part of the three numbers in the lake eutrophication standard. The assumptions of that standard are that if you hit the 60, you will also automatically hit the other numbers.
I think I understand. So you're not arguing that you have to impose a limit to meet 60 based on 60 itself.
Right. It's the holistic standard, lake eutrophication standard.
Okay. Which I think is different than what your brief says. Because your brief says, although Fail Lake is not considered impaired when assessed for attainment under the 7050, federal regs provide that for purposes of the water quality, the WQBELs, each of the numeric criteria comprising the standards must be attained and maintained. But which seems to suggest that the 60 has to be obtained and maintained without regard to the response criteria, but that's not what you're saying. Okay, go ahead.
It does, because that's the applicable standard. If MPCA said we could meet something other than 60 and we can meet something other than the associated response variables for the lake, they would establish a site-specific standard and the numbers would be something else. They're not establishing a site-specific standard here. So as long as the standard published in rule applies, all of the numbers have to be met.
It only applies where there's an exceedance. I mean, there has to be an exceedance before you would, a reasonable potential for exceedance before you would impose the standards, right? Before you would impose a limitation, and the limitation is designed to meet the standards, right?
Yes, there has to be reasonable potential, but it doesn't have to be for a current impairment. It's a reasonable potential for a contribution to an impairment. That could be a contribution to an impairment in the future.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, I'll look more closely at the federal regs and our state regs and see. But again, and I guess my next question relates to that, which goes to this assumption that you have to meet the numeric in order for the response to be met. And you said no one, let me get my notes here. I think you said no one is arguing that response variables don't act as expected for Lake Osakis, and therefore it's appropriate to use the 40 and as the criteria to and assume that the response will be met. But did the MPCA explain that in any of the documents that it was only using the 40 because no one was arguing that the response variables don't act as expected for Lake Osakis?
No, Your Honor, and they wouldn't have needed to do that. I mean, if nobody is coming to them and saying, hey, we think there's a problem with Lake Osakis's designation, then they would have responded to that point. But no one came to them and said that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, Judge Cochran?
No, thank you very much for allowing me additional time.
And I'm going to turn now to Judge Johnson, who's been extremely patient, waiting to ask his questions.
And holding my breath for about 20 minutes. It's okay. I think there's a court history that if a judge inhales before the time runs out, the judge can ask a question so long as he or she doesn't exhale, but I may have not been complying with that. But Ms. Person, I want to ask about your interpretation of Rule 150. I think you're arguing that it applies only to the determination of an impaired condition, but not to the reasonable potential analysis. That seems inconsistent with Subpart one, which is has a caption policy and scope, and the third sentence says the agency shall determine two things: an exceedance of water quality standards or an impaired condition based on certain things, and so on. That's the first part of my question. The second part has to do with in Subpart five. The first three items there, it says in evaluating whether the narrative standards in subpart three are being met, the commissioner will use all readily available and reliable data and information for the following factors, including three things, which correspond to the LES. I mean, based on those things, it seems to me that Rule 150 applies to both types of determinations so that it also applies to the reasonable potential analysis. Can you respond?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure what you mean by this also applies to the reasonable potential analysis.
I thought you were arguing that it does not.
And it does not. And I guess what I'm saying is, if it did apply, I don't know how it would apply. I can't really wrap my brain around how this determination of whether a water is presently impaired, how that would be sort of attached to and be part of the modeling or data or analysis that would go into the reasonable potential determination of whether a discharge has the possibility of causing a future impairment or, you know, causing bringing water that's
causing an exceedance, right? Doesn't the federal rules talk about an exceedance?
Right, an exceedance.
And the word exceedance is used in subpart one of rule 150. So, and subpart 5A sets forth the three-part test, you know, or the two-part test, the causal measurements as well as the response measurements. So it seems to that it applies to both types of determinations. Why am I wrong?
I'm struggling to sort of understand where the question is coming from. And is this a similar question to what Judge Cochran was asking about, are we taking all three variables into account under the reasonable potential analysis?
Yes, certainly related to that. But my understanding is that you've made the argument that you're not required to consider the effects or the responses when doing the reasonable potential analysis.
Well, the focus of the reasonable potential analysis is, could this discharge cause an impairment, right? So you
cause
certainly
an exceedance, right?
Cause an exceedance, but an exceedance could be thought of as synonymous with impairment. I mean, is it going to violate the water quality standard? If you violate the water quality standard, the water by definition is impaired. So you're in the reasonable potential analysis, you're looking at, is there the potential to cause or contribute to a violation of the water quality standard? With the water quality standard here, having the three different variables, as I was saying to Judge Cochran, all of those variables are factored in, but that's in part based on the assumptions of the standard itself, which were, you know, 20 years of data, and all of that was part of the rulemaking record showing that there is a relationship between the causal variable and the response variables. So, I mean, part of what the city is doing here is attacking the standard itself. And I am trying to explain that the standard was scientifically proven and accepted when it was promulgated. So we have to take that as a given that there is a relationship, a response relationship, that phosphorus is going to act on the chlorophyll A and succudepth. We have to take that as a given. If that's not true for a particular water body, then MPCA, in its discretion, could establish a site-specific standard that is different from what is promulgated in the rule.
But
MPCA grappled with that here and decided not to do so.
So there may be a correlation that's typical or a general correlation, but you didn't write, I mean, the agency did not write a rule that says we measure total phosphorus and that's it. We stop. You wrote a rule that says we measure total phosphorus and we also measure the chlorophyll and the transparency, and those are two additional measurements, and there's an exceedance only if the second or the third are also exceeded, right? And so, so in other words, having written that rule that you have to take three measurements, you have to find the first and then either the second or the third, I don't understand why you would argue today that the agency doesn't need to, can ignore the second or the third, can assume that a finding of an exceedance on the first, we can extrapolate it using an assumption that the second and the third must have been met as well, because that's not the rule you wrote.
Well, Your Honor, that's where the language of the reasonable potential regulation itself comes into play and talks about the pollutant that you can control, and the pollutant that can be controlled here is phosphorus. So if the agency was to make an impairment determination under 0.0150, they would be assessing, okay, is the phosphorus reaction happening? You know, there.
That kind of sounds like a preemption argument. I mean, are you saying that the federal rule supersedes the state rule to some extent? I mean, the state rule might require the second and the third measurements, but not because of the CFR?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that they're different tests and they're applied in different for different purposes. And so the 7050.0150 comes into play when deciding whether a water is going to be placed on the state's list of impaired waters and whether then a TMDL study needs to be done for that water. That is one scenario. It is a total separate scenario to determine whether a limit should be included in a permit. The analysis is different. It's the federal regulations that we rely on. And it's the water quality standard itself, which is not 0.0150. The water quality standard that we're looking at is in 7050.0222,
which is
not 0.0150.
But they're in the two rules are consistent with each other, right? I mean, the structure of the LES with to have the three measurements required matches up with subparts 5 and 5A, right?
Right, but the standard itself is what we look at, the standard in conjunction with 122.44D, so 40 CFR 122.44D, to determine if there's reasonable potential, and so to determine whether a permit limit is needed. That's a different process.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to ask one more question, and that is has to do with the timing of the agency's decision. So in September of 2020, the agency granted a request for a contested case hearing on the Lake Osakis TMDL. And then issued this permit in July of 21 before the contested case hearing had occurred. I mean, wouldn't that contested case hearing be useful to the agency in determining the conditions of the permit, and why didn't the agency wait until the contested case hearing was completed? And is that something that this court may review, the timing of the decision?
Two things. I'll say first that MPCA had the benefit of all the information that had come to light as part of the discovery process in the contested case hearing. So we already had, you know, additional, the 2019 and 2020 monitoring data from the city came to the agency as part of that contested case hearing. We had some back and forth with interrogatories and discovery and whatnot. And all of the information that the city was providing as part of the contested case hearing process affirmed and supported the 121 kilogram per year limit that the agency ultimately chose to include in the permit, right? So it had the benefit of this additional information, and all of that information supported MPCA's determination. In terms of, I think it's also important to point out as a second point that MPCA only granted the contested case hearing on the TMDL because that decision was made before the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision related to the North Met contested case hearing that was issued in 2021, I believe, 959 Northwest 2nd, 731 Minnesota 2021. And the standard changed. When MPCA granted the contested case hearing on the TMDL, the standard coming out of the Court of Appeals at that time was you grant a contested case hearing anytime there's a dispute on facts. Then the Minnesota Supreme Court clarified, no, the standard is whether the contested case hearing is expected to bring evidence to light that will aid the agency in its decision making. And here, everything that the city has presented to the agency throughout this entire decade of back and forth has been information that just contradicts the data that the agency is looking at. It's not providing anything new. It's just providing contradictory information, and the agency disagrees with the contradictory information and has explained why it disagrees.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions from panel members? Okay, thank you. I do have one last quick question, Ms. Pearson, and this should be a short answer. It should just be yes or no, but I just want to clarify a question that Judge Cochran had, that you stated that the assumption argument that you're making, that if the phosphorus, total phosphorus is met, that the other two variables will be met as well. That is a different argument than what you made in your briefing, correct?
I don't know that I said it that way, but no, it's consistent with what I said in the brief.
Okay, that's not what I had heard you say. I just want to confirm that, but okay, thank you. Thank you very much for your answers to all our questions. We realize that we went well over our time, but we appreciate you taking the time to provide those answers. We'll now turn back to appellant for response. I realize that opposing counsel has been given quite a bit of time, but I would ask that you answer, and we may have several follow-up questions, but if you can try to keep your answers as brief as possible. But go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Pearson, I want to make maybe two points, and then if there's any other questions. I think the first point is that it's pretty clear to me what happened here, right? The agency calculated this limit in 2012 based upon its misapplication of the lake standards to a wetland. And then since that time, despite increasing levels of new evidence, the MPCA has essentially said, we're not going to budge and change that limit. And they put that same assumption into a bunch of other analysis, and they don't want to change it. And
counsel, though, what about the June 2020 justification for the limit? Doesn't that suggest that they did an analysis for Lake Osakis and what was needed for that lake?
So, Your Honor, I would draw your attention to, and Ms. Pearson referenced the two technical memorandum in the record that the agency really did in this case, summarizing its modeling, and that's the 2011 analysis. And Ms. Pearson talked about that 2011 analysis was for applying the lake eutrophication standards to the Clifford wetland and the city of Osakis. So that analysis is really not valid, as acknowledged by MPCA's brief. It doesn't have eutrophication water quality standards to apply to wetlands. The second analysis is the one in 2014 that they did, where they were really looking at whether or not that limit that they gave the city based upon the Clifford wetland was applicable or protective. And those are direct quotes from that memorandum. They weren't looking at whether it was necessary to maintain and attain standards in Fail Lake. They were basically looking to confirm whether the limit that they set for Clifford was still protective of Fail Lake. And I would note that despite what the 2020 kind of memo, which is kind of summarizing this earlier memo, said, and that 2020 memo was written after this case was clearly in a litigation posture. But the 2014 memo does not address Lake Osakis or downstream waters. The analysis and the modeling that is presented in that 2014 memo is strictly based upon Fail Lake. And as we point out in the record, MPCA has basically stated, we didn't use our model to look at the relationship between phosphorus and chlorophyll A. But as we point out, and in that 2014 memo, there is an output in that modeling analysis that shows, basically confirms the city's now water quality data, real water quality data, confirmed back in 2014, because it showed that if the Fail Lake came into compliance with 60 TP criterion, then the algal criterion and the Secchi disk criterion would be in substantial compliance. So, but the larger point, and hopefully that addresses your question, Your Honor. The larger point that I want to make is basically the agency is doing two things. They're attempting to rewrite their lake eutrophication standards by hiding behind the deference that it knows that this court has historically given it when interpreting 40 CFR 122.44 D1. But again, as I stated in the beginning, the agency's interpretation in this case is directly inconsistent with its interpretation of that same regulation applying state eutrophication water quality standards in Winstead. And it's inconsistent with this court's holding in Winstead. And so it's unreasonable for the court to defer to the agency's interpretation of that regulation in Winstead and then defer again in this case where it directly conflicts. And then the second, and this is really the crux of the issue, I think, is that the city's asking for its day in court between an independent fact finder. This is a really complicated case, and the city has put forth compelling material data, expert modeling, and all we're asking for is the opportunity to present that to an independent fact finder, because throughout this process, the city has felt that MPCA has not viewed that evidence and treated it fairly and looked at it independently. And that's all that we're asking for. And this court really only needs to determine under the North Met case that the agency's conclusion that a contested case hearing wouldn't be helpful to the commissioner in this case is unreasonable based upon the record. And the key fact in the record that makes the MPCA's conclusion unreasonable is that the agency already granted a contested case hearing on these exact issues in the TMDL matter. And there are basically functionally equivalent cases. And if I may be just allowed one more moment to finish.
Yes, you may.
Thank you. The issues raised in the TMDL matter are identical to the issues raised in the permit matter in this case. They're talking about the exact same limit. They're talking about the exact same water quality standards. And in both cases, MPCA is relying upon the same factual basis. And so for them to say, under the same regulatory requirement, Minnesota Rule 7,1900, that in the TMDL matter, it would help the commissioner, but now it won't, when the only thing that changed is their assessment of the litigation risk for the agency, is patently unreasonable.
I heard Ms. Person say that they did benefit from the contested. It sounds like the contested case hearing has occurred or discovery has occurred, but that the agency did benefit from that process, even though there hasn't been a decision by the ALJ. Is it necessary to wait for a decision by an ALJ?
Yes, Your Honor, and to be clear, the contested case hearing did not go forward. Discovery was largely concluded, but the case is currently stayed. And this is another key fact in this case that is analogous to the facts that the North Met Court found persuasive when granting contested case hearings, both in the Owatonna case and on the bentonite issue. And I would draw the court's attention to the North Met permit to mine case, page 748 to 755. Because in that case, the court found it persuasive that when an agency dismisses expert analysis in a conclusory manner, that is an indication that the agency is exercising its will rather than its judgment. And we have that exact fact in this case. The modeling that the city's experts prepared wasn't complete when discovery was complete from the TMDL matter. So that modeling was being prepared for the contested case hearing in the TMDL. So the agency didn't have that. The city provided it to the agency for the first time before MPCA issued the permit and before they denied the contested case hearing. And in their order denying the contested case hearing and issuing the permit, the agency didn't even refer to that modeling analysis. The agency didn't even respond to that modeling analysis until prompted by the city when we requested a reconsideration and a stay, and they basically put a page and a half letter with bullet points responding to a detailed modeling analysis from the agency's own nationally recognized expert who had designed a model that was capable of doing exactly what MPCA's model couldn't do. If that's not a conclusory response that indicates that the agency had already made up its mind before seeing the evidence, I don't know what is. And if the city, bottom line, I think, if the city can't get minimum a contested case hearing in this case with instructions from the court that the agency apply the law as it's written, then I don't know who gets a contested case going forward. Because the evidence that we've put in, including completed modeling and hard water quality data, is, as the North Met Court talks about, it's a bevy of material evidence. And if I can just make one last point to highlight the legal error in this case. And I heard MPCA make conflicting arguments about how it was actually applying the lake eutrophication standards. And frankly, we've been hearing that from the beginning, and that's part of the frustration for the city in this case. But in the agency's brief on page 28, the agency says the relationship between phosphorus and the response variables is irrelevant in this case. I don't understand how they can make that statement when looking at the plain language of its own lake eutrophication standards. And the record is clear that throughout this case, the agency told the city the applicable standard is the phosphorus criterion for purposes of permitting. And that simply does not gel with the plain language of the agency's regulations.
Andreas, can I ask a quick follow-up?
Yes, please.
With regard to Lake Osakis, counsel for the MPCA stated that no one's arguing that the response variables don't act as expected for Lake Osakis. Can you respond to that?
The city is not contesting that Lake Osakis isn't impaired. And we don't have detailed analysis on the response variables in Lake Osakis, but because we had nothing to comment on because MPCA didn't do any. And they acknowledge that they didn't use their model to look at the response variables. And again, that's the larger point here. If MPCA were going to be starting from scratch today, they would say, according to their own guidance, Fail Lake isn't impaired. Let's look at the next downstream water, Lake Osakis, and let's do an independent, discrete modeling analysis and look at what level of phosphorus reduction from the city is necessary to attain and maintain water quality standards in Lake Osakis. They don't have that. They can't cite to the evidence in the record that shows that they have that other than assumptions and explanations. And just think about it. When the agency originally did all of its analysis for Fail Lake, which was in that 2014 memorandum in the record and the modeling analysis, they were operating under the assumption at that time, which according to the impaired waters list, it was true that Fail Lake was impaired. So they basically assumed for purposes of their entire analysis that Fail Lake was not impaired. Fail Lake was impaired when, as mentioned in our reply brief, Fail Lake, according to MPCA's own regs, should have never been listed as impaired in the first place. And now, if you look at page 14, where we have our table summarizing the water quality data, the data conclusively demonstrates from 2017 to 2020 that the long-term summer average concentration of phosphorus in Fail Lake is 135.5 micrograms per liter. The standard is 60. The chlorophyll A and Secchi disc criteria are in substantial compliance, despite the fact that over that same period, the average discharge from the city of Osakis has been 198 kilograms per year. That's empirical data. It's not modeling. It's not assumptions. That's what the facts show. And we're not asking the court to decide the facts and write the city's permit. We're really only asking for an opportunity to present our case to an independent fact finder all the way through.
Thank you, counsel. Any other questions from my colleagues? Okay. Thank you very much. We really appreciate both counsel taking the time to answer all of our questions, file extensive and well-written briefs, and have well-made arguments as well. We appreciate it from both counsel. We'll be taking this under advisement and